This is Audible.
Last Word Audio presents an unabridged recording of Masters of Deception, The Gang That Ruled Cyberspace by Michelle Slatala and Joshua Quittner. Read for you by Colby Elliott. Prologue. You get a crazy fast busy signal, like on Mother's Day when all the long distance lines are jammed. Dial again, busy. Dial again, busy, 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 busy. Slam it down. The phone system is crashing. The giant computers that route AT&T customers' long-distance calls, computers called switches, are shutting themselves down, behaving idiotically in a way that only computers can. Switches are the building blocks of the phone network, and when they start throwing electronic tantrums, the world stands still to watch. There's no choice. It's happening today, all across America, as the phone company slogan, "We're All Connected," took on a new, darker meaning. Suddenly, we're all disconnected. It's January 15th, 1990, and millions of people are hopelessly jabbing the keypad, dialing the 1, dialing the 3-digit area code, dialing a 7-digit number, waiting, getting a busy signal, trying again, getting a recording. 150 million long-distance calls a day travel these phone lines, threading through a massively intricate complex of Earth-orbiting satellites, microwave transmitters, and millions of miles of fiber-optic cable under the Atlantic Ocean. Long, spindly strands are buried beneath railroad tracks or strung from utility poles that crisscross the Great Plains. The signals they carry all converge on some of the most powerful and delicate computers on the planet. So much could go wrong, but AT&T has never failed so spectacularly before. Never let its customers down. No natural disaster has ever compromised the phone company's dependability. A few weeks ago, an earthquake measuring 7.2 on the Richter scale collapsed freeways in California, and the phone line still worked fine. But not today. AT&T estimates that half of its customers' calls aren't getting through. 75 million calls blocked. And the failure was sudden. At 2:25 p.m., one switch failed. Just one at first. Who knew why? It sent out a distress message to another switch, which should have been able to take over. But instead, the second switch went crazy too, unable to cope with the bad news. It had a cascading effect as one switch after another took itself out of service, and it was getting worse. Switch after switch after switch. What caused this damage? What force is so powerful, so dangerous, so heedless that it crashes a nation's communication system? In AT&T's New Jersey headquarters, dozens of technicians and bosses and engineers and control center specialists all want the answer. They stare at the world maps, two stories tall, that line one wall in the control room. The map suddenly flashed red in unison, screaming emergency alert. No warning, no gradual escalation. One minute the phones work, the next, parts of the Northeast are out. Businesses that depend on phones are crippled. They're missing tens of millions of dollars in sales. Customer service departments are sending their 800-line representatives home early. People are panicking because they can't get through to their elderly parents in other states. AT&T operators are giving out Sprint and MCI access numbers to frustrated customers. AT&T spokesmen are calling for calm. Two teenagers in Queens are wondering if it's all their fault. Mark keeps vampire hours, cramming for exam hours, late, late, late show hours, hacker hours. In the middle of a Monday afternoon, Mark should be at his internship, which he has to complete unless he wants to drop out of yet another high school. If not at work, Mark should be asleep. Mark definitely should not be on the phone calling Paul. "Did you hear?" Mark says. "AT&T crashed." "What?" says Paul. "What did you say?" "AT&T crashed. It's on the news." Paul sits upright on the red and black velvet couch in his mom's living room, startled awake from a nap, already knowing there's no way he'll ever go back to sleep. Not today, not tonight, probably not for the rest of his life. "AT&T crashed? Oh, God." Paul's scared. Are they saying hackers did it? Did he do it? Could he have done it? He doesn't think so. He doesn't want to believe it. He has never in his life wanted to believe anything less. But the fact remains that the other night Paul was sitting at the computer in the basement of his family's house in Cambria Heights, the computer clandestinely hooked up through the phone line to a sensitive portion of AT&T's system. Paul had diddled with the AT&T routing tables on a local switch owned by New York Telephone, typing first this command and then that one in an attempt to understand how the phone system works. This is what Paul likes to do. The routing tables are like train schedules that a New York telephone switch uses every time a long-distance call comes in. The switch routes each call over the proper carrier, AT&T, MCI, Sprint, so that the call can shoot instantaneously across the country and ring the phone in your grandma's house in California. It's a fabulously complex process, and no hacker in America could resist fooling with it if he knew how to get inside the system. Of course, very few hackers could get past the security in the first place. Paul had been sneaking in for months. He was the quiet programming genius behind the hacker gang known as the Masters of Deception. And so had Mark, the teacher in MOD, who knew more about phone company computers than just about anyone. A few of the other guys in the group might have been able to do it too, like Eli, the handsome smooth talker, or John, a newcomer and the only black kid in the gang, or Julio, John's younger sidekick from the Bronx. But who could be responsible for damage like this? No self-respecting computer hacker would ever destroy anything. No hacker would ever purposely hurt the phone system. Paul just wanted to look around. He just wanted to learn more. He'd known it if he'd done something bad, wouldn't he? And what about Mark? In the 6 months leading up to this crash, on Martin Luther King Day, Mark alone has made 69 unauthorized calls to AT&T computers in Chicago and Portland, Maine. Each time, Mark secretly coupled his $300 computer to AT&T's multi-million dollar monsters and, well, looked around. That's what Mark does. He's a hacker, and he breaks into unknown computers and tries to figure out how they work. His calls to AT&T computers totaled more than 12 intoxicating hours of exploration. Paul and Mark know they're not allowed inside the AT&T system. It's illegal. The truth of the matter is that AT&T doesn't want some inexperienced teenagers from New York City testing the limits of its machinery. The kids are smart. There's no denying it. If they weren't smart, they couldn't get into the computers in the first place. And Paul and Mark were well-intentioned. They just wanted to learn how things work. How else are they going to get access to study such a magnificent panoply of computer hardware? But once inside corporate computers, Mark and Paul don't know what they're trampling or where they're headed. Not really. They learn by trial and error. What happened? Paul asks. He's afraid to hear the answer. Afraid not to hear it. No one's saying, Mark says. Paul pictures his friends at the cramped table that serves as his bedroom desk on the other side of Queens. Mark usually sits hunched over the beat-up telephone handset that he has modified and customized with much intuitive fiddling and electrical tape. Mark has taken the thing apart and put it back together, examining its innards so many times that the tape is like a truss holding in the entrails. I don't think it could be hackers, Paul says, in the same deliberate tone he uses to measure out all his pronouncements. But what he's thinking, what he's fearing, what every bit of his brain is hoping is this. Please don't let it be my fault. The phone call from Mark to Paul lasts only a few minutes. In fact, if you really want to know how long it takes, you could ask the box, the DNR. The Hakimian dial number recorder that sits on the 23rd floor of the New York Telephone Company's headquarters in Midtown Manhattan, down the hall from the cigarette smoke-filled office of the security department's toll fraud unit. The box knows everything that matters. It watches Mark's phone, knows whenever someone lifts the receiver in the two-story brick row house in Elmhurst, Queens. The box records every phone number dialed from Mark's home, and it notes the hour, the start time, the end time, and the duration of each call. It funnels the information into a mini-computer that stores it for as long as anyone wants. And guess what? The box also watches Paul's phone. It's been watching for a while. Months, in fact. But don't worry. It's no big deal. The box doesn't stop them from making any calls. The box just watches and writes down what it sees and waits. 1. It all started back in 1989, months before the AT&T crash, months before Paul and Mark even knew each other's names. The whole mess, which would grow into a world-class electronic gang war fought by hackers from New York City to Texas, started back before Paul even knew what a switch was. If you want to trace it back to one night, to one single instant when you can say the whole story really began, you will see this image. Paul, in the dark, peering into a garbage dumpster. It's an early summer evening, warm on your skin, when Paul leans over the edge of the dumpster as far as he can. This is one way to become a computer hacker, the way Paul has chosen. He tries to snare one of the five or six invitingly swollen bags that sit in the bottom of the dumpster. It's not enough to be 6 feet tall because Paul still can't reach the bags, not until his stomach becomes the fulcrum for his body and his feet actually leave solid earth. He dangles. The blood is rushing to his head, making him dizzy. And yet there's nowhere he'd rather be than here, rummaging around in this dark alley in a dumpster full of phone company trash, looking for computer printouts. He came for the documents, but he also came for adventure. Right after scarfing down a quick supper, Paul had mumbled goodbye to his mom, who was still getting used to the fact that his dad had all of a sudden died. He had hopped a bus to the end of the line. He got off in Jamaica, Queens, at Parsons Boulevard and Hillside Avenue, an intersection in a neighborhood hot with bodegas, bars, and Bieber rental joints. He stood for a while, afloat in the dwindling stream of commuters flowing from the subway, and then a black Supra full of teenagers pulled up to the curb, and the dark-eyed guy in the driver's seat checked him out, smiled. Paul got in. "Let's go trashing," somebody in the back seat said. "There's a CO in Astoria." It's cool to be talking in a kind of hacker's code. The word trashing means climbing around in garbage, where you hope to find computer printouts that list secret passwords and logons. And CO, as everybody in the Supra knows, means central office, as in New York Telephone's central office in Astoria, Queens. Somebody broke out the Ballantines and the old English 800s, and Paul took one. He knew only one of the other guys in the car, and that was his best friend, who calls himself Hack. Until tonight, Paul had never physically met the driver, Eli Lidopoulos, only knew him by his nickname, Acid Freak. This was not unusual. Everybody in the Hacker Underground has a handle, but you rarely get to meet face-to-face, and even more rarely get to sit together in a dark car speeding in the night toward a dumpster stuffed with telco secrets. With rush hour over, it took less than 20 minutes to drive from Eli's neighborhood to the other end of Queens. When they reached Astoria, even the building itself thrilled Paul a little. This filthy red brick giant that takes up most of the block. Across the front, chiseled over the door, it says, Telephone Building. Like on a board game or something. Does the park across the street have a big sign that says park over it? No way. This building was named back when there was only one telephone company, Ma Bell. They sidled up to the front of it. There are bars on all the two-story windows, and through them you can see a vast loft-like fluorescent wash space. Imagine a library, hushed and eerie, but instead of books, all the shelves are filled from floor to ceiling with rack after rack of circuit boards. It's called the frame. There are even rolling ladders with signs that say, caution, look up before climbing. Like what kind of doofus wouldn't look up before climbing? Upstairs in the building, connected to all those wires, is the switch. But Paul doesn't even know what to call this large computer. But he's seen one now, and he'd soon learn its name. The switch is the biggest computer you ever saw, and its job is to control every phone line in Astoria. When a phone company customer in an apartment over the Taekwondo martial arts studio on 31st Street wants to order a pizza from around the corner, the phone call travels on copper cables to the switch, which funnels it to the pizza parlor's line. Multiply that by a couple hundred thousand lines in this part of Queens, and millions of phone calls a day, and you see what we're dealing with. Now, if you or your friends knew how to program a switch, or even knew a password to log on to a switch, you could start exploring. Go deep enough, learn your way around, and you'd be pretty powerful. Because you could control everybody's phone service, you could create an unbillable number for yourself or your friends. You could listen in on phone calls, and best of all, you'd really know how this fabulously complex hunk of electronic circuitry works. That kind of omnipotence is beyond the reach of the CEO of New York Telephone, but maybe not beyond the reach of some teenage computer hacker who was tenacious enough to scrounge around in the garbage until he found a password. This alone would be worth the trip. For a carload of teenage hackers, the opportunity to gawk through the big plate glass windows at the matrix of electronic circuitry is better than Dorothy's arrival in the Emerald City. Theoretically, tonight's conditions are ideal. It's an early summer weeknight, no rain, and the dumpsters are in a quiet alley on the side of the building. In the park, just enough kids are hanging out to provide an acceptable cover. There's plenty of promising garbage in big plastic bags, heavy as feed bags. It's much more auspicious than last week, when some guys took the trouble to climb the fence before they figured out the dumpster had already been emptied. Somebody on the street saw them, yelled up, "Hey, those windows don't open. You can't get any TVs up there." Like they would even want TVs. And theoretically, tonight's crew is ideally suited to the job. These teenagers are not Central Casting's idea of computer nerds. Not a plastic pocket protector in the bunch. Nobody squinting myopically through thick lenses. In fact, no one here wears glasses. And Paul and Hack, at least, are as muscled as the first-string running backs who graduated with them from high school last year. If they weren't so jumpy, they could toss around 30-pound bags like Nerf balls. Look at Paul. He's the pale, serious one. He's always the quiet one in the crowd. Because he's a big kid, his silence is intimidating, whether he means it to be or not. as he stands staring with flat Slavic eyes. Those eyes take in everything and return nothing. Eli is his physical opposite. He's the one the girls like, the hip-hop guy, the cool one. Eli has a slow smile that starts like a conspiracy and spreads up to his eyes and pulls you in. His eyes are black as blueberries. His hair is as black as his eyes. This is Paul's first time trashing, and frankly, if you knew him, you'd be shocked to see him here. He is, after all, the valedictorian of Thomas A. Edison High School's class of 1988, winner of the All-City Computer Programming Competition, a boy with a future. Paul learned to read before he got to kindergarten. He knew his colors and his numbers, and his favorite book was Three Billy Goats Gruff. He was captivated by the troll under the bridge. Maybe he would be all his life, maybe not. But at four, Paul was simultaneously drawn to and repelled by the powerful monster that lurked below. This was the authority figure that stood between you and where you wanted to go. By the time Paul was six, he knew why he wanted to cross the bridge. He learned about the computer on the other side. It looked like a typewriter, but had extra keys. He saw it at his dad's office Christmas party in 1976. The winking cursor on the phosphorus screen enchanted him. How did it work? The boxy computer was one of 20 that sat like a museum exhibit behind a plexiglass wall in the corner. Paul was taking the grand tour of the Royal Composing Room in Manhattan, where his dad was a typesetter. It was the first time he'd been to the office, and everyone was calling him Paulie, just like his dad did. When one of the guys saw him staring at the cursor with that look in his eye, he took Paul and his father into the climate-controlled, dust-free sanctum where the computers hummed. "Do you want to play around with one?" the guy asked. Paul sat down at the keyboard, which was similar to his mom's manual typewriter. Using only his index fingers, he pecked in each letter of a short article from that day's newspaper and watched as the words miraculously formed on the monitor. He could hit a key and just erase any error, type the word again. He typed the article perfectly. The same guy came back, inspected Paul's work, and printed it. Out came a piece of plastic film, 4 inches by 5 inches, with the article, some story about the old JFK administration, typesetting on it in black letters. Paul held it, still warm and smelling of chemical fixatives, and realized, if a computer did that, what can't such a wondrous machine accomplish? It was software that made the computer work. It was the code, the precise and logical lines of instructions that caused the silicon chips to react, just like neurons firing in a brain. It wasn't long before Paul was engrossed in magazines, reading about and actually digesting the rudiments of computer programming. He read Byte and Compute and Personal Computing. He didn't have a computer of his own and wouldn't for a few years. In fact, he didn't even have one at school. But that didn't stop Paul from becoming a programmer. He learned to speak the programming language called BASIC. Writing programs without having a machine to run them is like learning chess moves without a chessboard. You have to hold everything in your mind. But here's one thing about Paul. One thought follows another logically in rapid-fire progression. Paul thinks like a computer, so it wasn't so hard for him to start writing for one. The first program the 11-year-old ever wrote was a challenge he read in a magazine. Devise a program that will search two groups of 20 numbers and tell which is the highest in each group. Paul thought about this for a while, thought about how it should work, with each command flowing from the previous one so that the problem was solved methodically, and then he wrote. 5, high equals 0, 10, dim A, 20, comma, B, 20, 15, for I equals 1 to 20, 20, read A, subset I, 25, if A subset I is greater, high, then high equals A, subset I, 30, next I, 35, print highest value A is high, 40, high equals 0, 45, for I equals 1 to 20. 50, read B subset I. 55, if B subset I is greater, high then high equals B subset I. 60, next I. 65, print highest B value is high. 70, end. 100, data. 5, 8, 2, 15, 7, 3, 7, 8, 36, 18, 45, 32. 68, 55, 44, 0, 16, 7, 8, 2, 110, data, 6, 4, 6, 8, 6, 7, 8, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 14, 15, 33, 22, 11. The program would sift through the two sets of numbers at the end and identify 68 and 33 as the highest. Paul could tell just by looking at the terse lines of code that it would work. It had taken him 10 minutes to write it. Then he wrote a program that tracked NFL football team statistics during the season, wins, losses, standings. Some programmers will tell you that it can ruin an up-and-coming hacker to learn to write in the computer language called BASIC because it's so clunky and primitive. Sure, you can write any program in BASIC. You could write code for the space shuttle if you wanted. But it would be millions of lines longer than writing the same program in a more efficient language. You can't express commands succinctly or elegantly in BASIC. Yet somehow the limitations didn't hinder Paul. The simple but sensible structure of the programming language hooked him. He wrote all his programs down in notebooks, page after page, with very little erasure. The funny thing was, when he finally got his hands on a computer years later, he never checked to see if any of the programs worked. He just knew they would. By the time he got to junior high and took his first real computer class, Paul could have been the teacher. A typical assignment took him about 2 minutes to complete. His teacher let him zip along at his own pace. The other students didn't know that BASIC was a simple interpreter for those more complex native tongues computers speak, known as machine language. Machine language is a kind of numeric Morse code in which all the commands are expressed in a sequence of zeros and ones instead of in words recognizable to humans. Paul was now talking directly to the computer in machine language. Some people always remember their first car. Others, their first bike. These are the things that promise to liberate us from our ordinary lives and take us to places where anything is possible. Paul will always remember his first computer. He got it in 1983, a gift from his parents, a Commodore 64 just like the ones at school. No one in his family knew anything about computers, but his uncle bought him Commodore's own Programmer's Reference Guide. Another guy might tinker endlessly with his 64 Mustang. Paul had his Commie 64, and man, did he get a kick out of peering under its hood. He'd open up the box and look at the microprocessors, understanding at the most basic level how the computer digested information, how the hardware interacted with software. One thing about the Commie 64, it could run an awesome library of games if you had the money to buy them. He bought Annihilator and 3D Pac-Man. They each cost $20. But Paul's taste got more expensive, and the best games cost up to $50. So he traded with his friends. After a while, the games themselves weren't that challenging. Cracking their copyright protection was. When the first generation of games hit the market, there was no such thing as software cracking. Games came on cassette tapes and were meant to be copied. But with the advent of floppy disks, the world changed. Software became a big business. The software companies realized that they needed to protect their franchises. The last thing they wanted was one teenager in Cambria Heights buying one copy of Zork and passing it out to 100 pals. That's 100 times $50 that companies don't make. So the company started to lock down their software. It was easy at first. The programmers simply hid an intentional error on a part of the floppy disk. They called it Error 23. Then, every time the game loaded, they had to verify that Error 23 was on the disk. The beauty of it was that most software programs wouldn't copy a disk that had an error on it. The floppy drive on the copying computer takes one scan of the disk and says, "No way." But wait a second. Didn't some kid just fork out $50 for this program? Shouldn't he be able to copy it as many times as he wants? It's his, after all. What if his sister accidentally, on purpose, stuck his disk in the microwave? How's he going to play? This was a widespread concern among teenage boys all over the country. It was perhaps their first conscious political stand. Even if they didn't know it, they were following a basic truth identified by Whole Earth Review founder Stuart Brand. Information wants to be free. To liberate it, these kids became whereas dudes, amateur software pirates who put their collective ingenuity together. They traded tips for breaking lame copy protections. They even wrote little lockpicking programs like Quick Copy that could copy a disk protected by measly Error 23. It was a macho thing to do. Computer macho. Naturally, the companies abandoned Error 23. Trying to be sequentially cryptic, they used Error 21 to protect their games. The first one with Error 21 was Flight Simulator, so you can imagine how anxious the dudes were to crack it. Some guy in Canada wrote a program that could copy a disk with Error 21. He called it Fast Hack'em. That worked for a while. Then the hottest new game to hit the Whereas circuit was released, Summer Games for Commodore. Its advent coincided with the 1984 Olympics. and it had 8 different games, including a totally awesome pole vault event that required you to jiggle your joystick as fast as you could to propel your little pole vaulter across the screen, up and over a little bar. The graphics were the best. Paul did not have $50 for the game. Now, Paul did not use Whereas Dude utility programs like Fast Hack'em. Not that it would have helped on summer games. A guy who reads BASIC like it's his mother tongue can Fast Hack'em on his own. If he wanted to copy a game, he simply loaded a program onto his computer that allowed him to X-ray the game. He could see all the underlying code on the game's disk, could see the hidden error, and tweeze it out like a splinter. That's why kids would bring Paul new games fresh out of the shrink wrap. Some of Paul's friends worked at computer stores. At the end of their shifts, they would sort of borrow a game and bring it to him. The next day, they'd return the original to the store. Paul never made a penny off this. He was more interested in defeating the troll.
Summer Games was tougher, though. Summer Games was the first one with Error 29. Someone brought Paul a legitimate copy. At first, it stumped him. Then he approached the problem like he approaches everything. He broke it down to its basic parts, figured out how each part works separately, and then figured out how they work together. Just like an engineer. He scanned the sectors of the disk, looking for a clue. If he tried to delete the error, the program would still instruct the computer to look for the error, and, not finding it, wouldn't run. The computer would say it found zero. Zero was a problem, because the software expected to find error 29. But then Paul figured it out. He could remove the error and at the same time convince the computer that it wasn't looking for an error. Don't look for error 29, he told the computer. Look for zero. If you can't get rid of the troll, go around it. It was a way of acknowledging that the error existed while negating the power of the error. Now he could make a million copies if he wanted. Paul was proud of his work. He was an artist, and no artist wants to hide in a garret. Paul signed his work, inserting a new line at the bottom of his pirate floppies. This game cracked by Scorpion PWS. Who was Scorpion? Paul didn't know. Scorpions were fast, silent, and dangerous. He knew who PWS was. 14-year-old Paul William Styra. He hoped the two were the same person. Scorpion wouldn't be afraid to take risks. Scorpion wouldn't balk at climbing a fence and jumping into a phone company dumpster in Astoria, which is not to say it's relaxing to be the bag man. Every time an ambulance screams by on its way to Astoria General Hospital emergency room down the street, Paul starts and squints into the dark as if he expects to be pinned in the beam of a police flashlight. Hacks up on the roof of a utility shed next to the dumpster, and Eli is down on the street. Paul's the only one who might not make it to the super if the cops come. He tries to concentrate on the work, feel around in the dark for a bag, hope it's a dry one, and then haul it up from the pit and pass it to Hack. It's like a bucket brigade, except that every time Paul hoists a bag, he almost loses his balance and falls into the dumpster. Do rats live in dumpsters? Paul wonders. Scorpion mastered the art of cracking games. He needed new places to go, new worlds to conquer with his computer. By the time Paul entered high school, a friend had slipped him a sheet of paper with some phone numbers on it. The phone numbers were for hacker bulletin boards. They were electronic meeting places, these bulletin boards. All you needed was a modem that could connect you to electronic networks and a computer that could whisper a password, and you were in, reveling in the allure of the forbidden. Or so it seemed to teenage boys. Your computer did the knocking for you. Just tell it what phone number to dial, type the password, when you're prompted for one, and you'd be connected. Then you could type messages to other people who had logged in. People who liked the same things you did. People who might know a little bit more than you. People to hang out with. At a time when boys in other parts of the country were getting their driver's licenses, Paul was saving up to buy the one thing that stood between him and all the electronic bulletin boards in the world, a modem. A modem took the digital language of your computer and translated it into analog, the continuously varying sound waves that the telephone network was built to carry. Without a modem, Paul was just a hermit in a basement, typing alone. Without a modem, the phone numbers he carried around in his pocket were useless. Any kid with a halfway decent computer setup and his own phone line for the modem, nothing pissed the folks off faster than having the house line tied up all night long, could procure the software to run his own bulletin board. The boards all had evocative names. You'd hear of a board called Pirate's Cove, and you'd know it attracts software crackers who want to trade pirated games. You'd hear of a board called Fuck the Feds, and you'd know you're dealing with something else entirely. These boards were real places, though some operated for less than a week before they imploded. Kids congregated on certain boards where they knew they'd find their friends. Sometimes they'd even arrange to meet at a certain time and go to the other boards together. It was like an electronic street corner where they'd meet, then cruise together through cyberspace, and nobody ever had to leave his bedroom. A good board would also attract its share of hacker celebrities, kids who'd built up reputations through their computer exploits or by boasting of their prowess, or maybe just because they'd use a really clever hacker handle. A good board would attract elite hackers, the top-tier guys with really cool names like Eric Bloodaxe and Fiber Optic, guys who were in gangs, voted in because of their specialized expertise. There were wannabe gangs, and then there were real gangs, whose members would crow and scrawl their proud graffiti over bulletin boards throughout cyberspace. But no gang was more real, more revered, than the Legion of Doom. The Legion of Doom was the best of the best from the 50 states. A few of the Legion's members lived in New York. One LOD member, the brash and brilliant Fiber Optic, who arguably knew more about the intricacies of the phone system than anyone alive, was rumored to live in Queens. He cruised all the local boards, and if Fiber Optic graced a bulletin board with comments about this or that phone company secret, then other hackers spread the word, "Fiber's on. This place is hot." A crowd would congregate. The phone lines would become busy, hackers desperately calling, instructing their computers to redial, trying anything to get through, trying to get past a busy signal that was as implacable as any nightclub bouncer. You could find anything on a good board. A good board would be honeycombed with all sorts of treats in the form of text files you could read, recipes for homemade bombs, pilfered long-distance calling car codes, advice on how to cheat payphones. Only the files weren't called files. They were called PH files, an homage to the phone. The telephone, that holy device, is the most important tool a hacker has, since it connects him to the biggest computer system in the world, the phone network. So you can see why Paul needed a modem. He saved. It took a few months, lunch money here, a 16th birthday there. The master modem cost $50. It was the affordable modem, the VW Beetle of modems. It was slow, and it pulsed out like a rotary phone instead of using tones like a push button. But it got the job done, and it was the only one at Radio Shack in Paul's budget range. He also had to buy a phone jack and the cable to snake the phone line from the first floor down to the cellar, where the computer was set up. That stuff would cost between $10 and $20. Paul wasn't exactly sure how much, so he didn't want to waste money on bus fare to the mall. On a Sunday morning in April, his parents still in bed, Paul quietly slipped out the front door and breezed up 227th Street, mock two-door townhouses all in a row, cracks in the sidewalk, first daffodils in somebody's curbside garden. Cambria Heights was always held up as an integration success story, maybe because the whole process of one ethnic group moving out when another moved in was quieter here, less turbulent than in other parts of the city. Other Lithuanian families, just like Paul's, used to live in the neighborhood. In fact, before they died, Paul's grandparents lived within walking distance. But now, a black family would move in, a white family would move out. After a few years, you realize that most of the white families with kids had sneaked over the border into Nassau County, Long Island. Soon you were the only white boy in your class at public school 147Q. Of course, it was probably a lot easier to be the only white kid in a class in Queens than to be the only black kid in a class in Nassau County. And Paul, in his understated way, got along with everyone. He turned left and walked another 5 blocks to reach an underpass beneath a rotting parkway that divided the city from suburbia, divided Queens from Long Island. Instantly, the roads were better paved, the houses spaced a little farther apart, the litter not as noticeable, and graffiti non-existent. And still he walked, south now, through Elmont and Valley Stream, a good 3 miles, so desperate was he to spend his $60 and change. Why did he want this so much? He didn't know. He couldn't answer that question, just like he couldn't tell you why he once painstakingly wrote out a list of the dozens of conversation forums offered by CompuServe, a computer information service that a friend showed him. There was no point to the list that took up pages in his notebook back then. It was like Columbus having a map before he even had a boat. Paul got home from the Green Acres Mall before his parents woke up. He had the thing hooked up before 11 that morning. It made a marvelous clicking noise when it dialed the phone. He logged into a couple of bulletin boards, but he was just too excited to stay. He wanted to log in everywhere, but was limited to the phone numbers on his list. Within a week, Paul wrote a little program to help the modem find other computers. The program made the modem stay up all night after Paul went to sleep. The modem's job was to dial toll-free 800 numbers sequentially. It was a lot like in the movie War Games. a movie that influenced Paul and his friends in the same way that Rebel Without a Cause had captivated an earlier generation of Lost Boys. In fact, this type of program is known as a War Games dialer. The modem might start by dialing 800-555-0000. If someone answered the phone, or if the phone just rang and rang, the modem would disconnect. Then it would dial 800-555-0001, and so on. The modem was hunting for other computers. When it found one, when the modem heard a fellow modem beep a greeting, Paul instructed his computer to make a note of that phone number. All night long, Paul could hear the modem pulse dialing, clickety-clickety-click. It took a long time to scan numbers this way, but it didn't matter. Calling toll-free numbers didn't cost anything. The next morning, Paul would look over the night's work and see 10 or even 20 computers' phone numbers on the list. Within 4 years, he would have the numbers to 1,000 computers. During his junior year, Paul was a system operator of the high school electronic bulletin board. It was really more of a chat board, because nobody posted anything illegal, like credit card numbers, or sexy, like how to blow up the toilet. Hardly anybody called, in fact, except this guy who used the handle Hack, who also owned a Commie 64 and went to high school in Flushing. He lived near Shea Stadium, where the Mets play baseball. One night, on the board, Paul and Hack got into one of those arguments, where at the end you realize you're both saying the same thing. They argued over the definition of the word hacker. First, Hack said that hackers didn't exist anymore. He said the word referred to the pioneering hardcore computer programmers of the 1960s. Those guys at MIT loved nothing more than writing, also called hacking, code. They were people whose love for computing bordered on the obsessive. They weren't guys who broke into computers, unless you count the times they sneaked processing time on the big mainframes, locked up in climate-controlled rooms. Paul said he knew that, but he said hacking wasn't dead, pointing out that hackers today were interested in the same things, only they caged processing time by sneaking in over telephone lines. They were different from crackers, who just like to break into systems and have no idea what to do once they got there. It was then that they realized they held the same opinion about a lot of things, so they met face to face. It's a funny thing about the computer world. You can talk to a guy for hours, have the most kick-ass conversations, and never know what the dude looks like. They would hang out at the Queens Mall. Paul slouched through the shopping center, wearing his nylon black ice windbreaker and listening to Hack talk for hours. They sipped really huge cups of mall coffee with lots of milk and sugar. Paul could drink 4 cups. Paul would tell Hack about the new computers that his modem had found scanning. Hack, it turned out, had also been scanning 800 numbers. Paul told Hack that he explored new computers by calling back the number from his computer. He figured that most of them were owned by private companies. Some would prompt, password. Others wouldn't prompt him at all. They would just wait, passively, for a certain amount of time. Then they would disconnect him. Paul would try to figure out what sort of computers they were, and he would try to guess passwords. The computer system would identify itself as belonging to, say, the XYZ Corporation, and sometimes the password would be a variation of the company's name, like ZYX. Sometimes the password would simply be test or guest or password. 1 out of 30 times, Paul could guess the password. One day, Paul sat at his desk, randomly dialing telephone numbers. He was searching for a phone company computer. He knew from reading messages on bulletin boards that the phone company computer lines were often stashed up in the high numbers, up above 9900. Let's say Paul was looking in exchange 555. He would dial 555-9900, just to see what happened. Nothing. Then he would dial 555-9922, just for variety. He hated to dial numbers in sequence. He could dial any couplet, from 00 to 99, haphazardly, but without hitting any number twice. 555-9973, nothing. 555-9918, nothing. 555-9956, nothing. Then he hit one. 555-9940, and things got weird. He told Hack about it. Neither of them could make much of the thing. Paul got a second phone line installed in his house and put up his own hacker bulletin board called Beyond the Limit. The name came from a movie Paul saw advertised in TV Guide. He never watched the movie, just liked the name. Not many hackers called Paul's board. In fact, only 3 did, and Hack was one of them. Hack got another kid he knew in Flushing to call, too. Hack was good at meeting people. A year after they graduated from high school, Hack called Paul and told him he had met this incredibly elite dude who seemed to know a lot about hacking. The dude claimed a blind guy in the neighborhood had taught him to make free phone calls. Hack really wanted Paul to meet this guy. His name was Acid Freak. Skulking in the lamplight, Eli is supposed to watch out for telephone company security goons and for anyone else who might want to know why these scraggly-ass teenagers are climbing over an 8-foot fence. Down on the pavement, Eli can see the whole length of 30th Street. It's crazy to climb over a fence onto private property when you're depending on the guy you hardly know as your lookout. If it had been anyone else but Acid Freak, Paul probably wouldn't have done it. But there was something about Eli, this new kid, that made Paul want to be part of whatever he's planning. Eli is a few months older than Paul, and even if he doesn't know as much about the mechanical aspects of computers and programming as Hack had been led to believe, he has other skills. He got his computer when he was 14, and ever since he's been calling people all over the world with his modem. Eli has friends everywhere. He's always game to try and break into different computer systems. He says he does it for brags. Paul hoists a bag over his shoulder, over his head, and hands it up to Hack. And then Hack hands it down to the sidewalk. That's the routine. But just as Hack is about to hand off the final bag, a man comes out of the telephone building and pauses a second longer than he should, and then gets into a car and rolls down the window and just sits there. The boys freeze. "What's he doing?" Paul whispers. "I don't know. He's just sitting in his car." Paul and Hack stand there, crazed alley cats, backs high, ears cupped, tense on tiptoes. And then the worst happens. In the distance, they hear a siren. It's not an ambulance, whose oral signature Paul would recognize at this point in the evening, but it's definitely a siren, and it's getting louder, closer. It's a banshee now, and it's just around the corner, and Paul, for one, has had it with dumpster diving. He climbs over the fence as fast as he can and follows a retreating Hack to the sidewalk. The siren's just about upon them, and they dash madly across the street, bags in tow, past the guy who's sitting in the car, now wide-eyed, watching the kids come leaping over the fence. Their sneakers hit the pavement with heavy slaps, and with barely a second to spare, they dive into a dark, safe spot in the park, just as a fire truck blazes past. The siren is gone. They look at one another. Their hearts pound. They can see the outline of the Triborough Bridge through the leafy trees. The green and white lights along its suspension beckon like a distant Ferris wheel. And it's an adventure again. They kneel on the handball court and rip the sacks open and paper printouts spill like entrails. The night is hot, and the streets are hopping, and you can probably even see stars. They don't look up. 2. Most of the dumpster's bags are full of garbage or containers of half-eaten Chinese food. But one bag is worth the trouble, because inside is a piece of paper that lists the phone numbers of about a dozen phone company computers in Queens. It's like a directory. No ordinary white pages, though. This is a secret list of internal New York telephone company numbers. It's an excellent find. Now you can call up the phone company business office, pretending to be Lou in provisioning. You can let it drop that you know all about a certain computer at a certain phone number. You're a part of the Great Bell family. And, of course, the business office is going to give you the information you request. You can sound like you know the person. Don't you remember me, Barry? We've talked before, fella. Another great thing about the list is that it's like a schematic diagram that tells which computers are in Queens and how they're related, how it all fits together. The list is a map of a trip that, until now, Paul and Eli had been taking separately. Before they met tonight, they were just your typical lone spelunkers rubbing their hands along cave walls in the dark. Now, with this shared experience, this set of directions, they're part of a team. There's a new breathlessness to them, a warm guy feeling, because when you're trying to figure out something as labyrinthine as the nation's phone system, it helps to have friends. The phone system is intentionally closed off to outsiders. Adolescent boys aren't supposed to be hooking up their computers to it, exploring its intricacies. But Paul and Eli and their friends are just playing an adventure game. This is merely a little trespassing. The very fact that they have to dive into a dumpster to get something as mundane as phone numbers for company computers only heightens their desire to get inside the system. A few days ago, just before they decided to meet for the garbage run, there was a moment on the phone when Paul decided to give Eli something. He told him a secret. Paul told Eli about the strange computer that answers the phone when he dials 555-9940, a number in Laurelton, Queens. "I think it has something to do with the phone system," Paul said, in a typically understated way. In fact, Paul had found 3 separate phone numbers that all seemed to dial the same computer in Laurelton. Almost every day, Paul had been hooking up to this computer and trying to figure out what it does. The work was tedious. At first, Paul would sit hour after hour at the keyboard, in the basement, trying one combination of letters, then another, hoping to stumble across some command that the computer would respond to. He had plenty of time because Paul wasn't the type to do homework. Even though he was number one in his class, he did better when he didn't study too much. Studying could actually make him freeze up on a test, could confuse him when it came time to think through the questions and write down the answers. So forget that. Besides, you learn more from a computer than from any book. Computers interact with you. You do something. The computer responds. It's almost organic. So while his mom watched TV in the living room, he tried to hack the strange computer. When his brother went off to work on the night shift in the subway, he tried to hack it. It was like jiggling a handle on a door, wondering what was on the other side. He knew it was technically illegal, but who would know? And who was he hurting? And who could possibly care? He didn't think it was morally wrong. 555-9940. 555-9941. 555-9942. But each number seemed to lead to a separate place in the computer, because each one behaved differently, he told Eli. It was one of those absorbing puzzles that would ultimately teach him something. This was far more complicated than programming in BASIC. There was no manual to tell him how to proceed. The last phone number was useless, actually, but it took him a long time to figure that out. Whenever he called 555-9942, he heard a sound, as if the computer were pulse dialing, like one of those old rotary phones. He was calling the computer, and here it was calling someone else on a rotary phone. Paul couldn't tell who the computer was calling, although all he had to do to figure it out was to count the clicks, but it dialed so fast he couldn't. He thought about this for a while, and then he dug out an old Panasonic cassette deck and recorded the clicks. He played it back over and over, but he still couldn't make out the number. The problem was that at normal playback speed, it was still too fast. There must be some way to slow it down. There was no variable speed switch on the cassette deck, like on a dictating machine. He couldn't put his finger on the capstan while it spun. What could he modify? He pulled out one of the 4C batteries that ran the tape recorder, put it in backward to offset the voltage, and that slowed the speed. After he figured out the phone number, he had his computer dial it. It was calling another computer in Jamaica, Queens, and he knew he connected because he heard the crash bang of his modem colliding with the other one. But his computer screen stayed black. Whatever he was connected to refused to acknowledge him. He got no prompt on his screen, nothing. He couldn't figure out what the computer wanted him to type. No combination of keys disturbed the blackness on his screen. That happens. When you're trying to feel your way through the cave, sometimes you just walk into the wall. Paul had better luck with 555-9940. At least this number responded. The trouble was the responses were wacky. The modem would connect, but when he tried to communicate with the computer, any key he hit on his keyboard seemed to be the wrong key. The computer at the other end would send back to his screen this inscrutable message, S. He'd try again, this time dialing the 555-9941 number, and the computer would tell him W. And that's what he'd get regardless of what he typed in response. S, S, S. W-W-W-W-W-W. He was trying every key combination. W-W-W-W-S-S. S-S-S-S-S-S-S-S-S-S-S-S-S-S. One day, in frustration, he picked up his phone receiver and blew into the mouthpiece. A short, airy blast, maybe 300 milliseconds long. And now, his computer would sputter a string of bizarre characters across the screen. Paul figured out it was some arcane timing pattern. Stranger still, now whenever he pressed a key, his own computer would ring a bell in response. Bing! He realized that his susurrations had somehow reset the computer at the other end. Now he could get it to respond. He would blow into it again, and then a question mark would appear on the screen. Paul could tell it what he wanted to do. Question mark. Log in? He was inside the phone system. Paul experimented by typing various commands he knew from different operating systems he'd fooled with. No good. Then one day he typed show users, and boom, a list of authorized users appeared on his screen. He wrote down the names. The next time he logged in, he assumed one of their identities. Now he was an authorized user. He learned that if he typed print and then the name of a file, he'd see a very helpful help file, which would explain what the directory was and what he could do with it. Like most computer systems, the phone company's computers were designed, after all, to help people. They were designed long before teenage hackers existed. They weren't built to repel a hacker menace once he had gotten into the system. So Paul got the computer to explain what the commands meant. For instance, by typing print QDN, he coached the computer to explain that the command QDN meant query directory number. He knew he was logged into something powerful because one day, when he was noodling around, he found a way to list phone numbers of people who lived in nearby Laurelton. Awesome. He looked for a phone number of a friend of his, a guy who worked at the Village Voice. He found it. But what could he do with it? He had a brilliant idea. He typed QDN 555-1234. Using QDN was a way to ask the computer to pull up the records of a particular phone number. Say the number in question was 718-555-1234. The computer asked Paul if he wanted to place a service order to modify service, S-O colon. Using the commands that Paul had found in the helpful help files, Paul typed ADD $555-1234 3WC $. Three-way calling, or 3WC, was now installed. When his friend wanted to add a third person to a phone conversation, he merely had to hit the flash hook on his phone. Paul could have just as easily typed CWT to add call waiting to the line. The computer did the hard part, but Paul had all the power. His friend never got billed for 3WC, and probably still has the feature to this day. By the time he had told Eli about some of this in the summer of 1989, Paul had been hooked into the phone company computer for about a year. But what kind of computer was it? It sounds like an SCCS, Eli said. What's that? Paul asked. A switching control center system, Eli said vaguely. Something to centralize switches in one area. The explanation didn't satisfy Paul. Something didn't sound right. Of course, there was no reason it would be right. Eli had much less experience than Paul in actually penetrating the phone company's computers. An SCCS, Paul repeated. Yeah, it's really big and beyond my expertise, Eli said. But that wasn't really a problem. Even if Eli didn't know that much about hacking, he certainly knew a lot of hackers. He knew where to go for help. Because this is who Eli is, a kid who knows everybody, a kid who everybody likes, a kid who everybody wants to help. Paul, in the guarded way he warmed to anyone, had certainly come to like him just from talking on the phone. That's why Paul went along on the dumpster dive. That's why, a few days later, when they were talking about the mysteries of the Laurelton computer again, Paul went along with another suggestion Eli made. Eli says they ought to find someone who would be interested in Paul's information. A phone company specialist who might be able to get inside other telco computers. Paul says okay. Eli says, I know this guy. But it turns out that Eli is not talking about just any guy. This is the dude. Eli's talking about fiber optic. Says he's even encountered fiber while roaming through cyberspace. Eli's never met him in person, but then who has? But Eli knows enough about fiber optic to know that he's the man with the answers. He's in the Legion of Doom, isn't he? He's the gang's phone guy, for God's sake. The Legion's exploits are legendary. The Legion is rumored to know how to break into ongoing phone calls. The Legion is rumored to have hidden the gang's own private bulletin boards inside corporate computer systems. The Legion's archives are rumored to be the repository of the best technical information in the underground. Paul doesn't know anybody in the Legion of Doom. He doesn't even know who's in this gang, founded by a notorious hacker named Lex Luthor. Eli says that if fiber optic got into the Legion of Doom, then fiber optic must be good. You have to be a little brave to even suggest calling a guy like that. You have to be pretty sure of yourself. Not afraid at all that the guy is going to hang up on you, or worse, listen to what you have to say and then ridicule you. You have to have a lot of confidence in yourself. Let's call him, Eli says. Paul says, okay. What do you want? The voice demands. I'm fiber optic of the LOD. If you heard it, you'd think it was the Wizard of Oz himself, standing behind his curtain and making steam hiss and fires roar. Fiber optic of the LOD. Both Paul and Eli hear it, the outrage in the deep voice that has answered the phone. Now, Eli once met fiber optic on a bulletin board. But that's little comfort now. Not with a real live member of the Legion of Doom on the other end of the phone, thundering and aggressive. A guy like that doesn't like you, he can turn you into a toad. Or at least turn your home phone into a payphone. Every hacker has heard the stories. heard of some poor rodent whose mom picks up the phone in the kitchen to call Linda next door, and instead of a reassuring tone, hears the recording, "Please deposit 25 cents. Explain that to your mom." Not that Fiverr's response is totally unexpected. How does he know he's not talking to a couple of lame wannabes on the phone? He gets these calls all the time, ever since word spread that he's in the Legion of Doom. What do Eli and Paul want of Fiverr? It's obvious. They heard he was the dude who was into phone company switches. But that's the simple answer. They really want much more, don't they? They want him to teach them not only about the phone systems, but also about all the sophisticated computers he's cracked, about the rare commands he can type, about the way his mind works. They want what any two boys with a little knowledge and a great curiosity want. They want a leader to show them the way. They tell him they have access to a computer in Laurelton, and they want to know what it is, what it's capable of doing. "We think we have this SCCS." "You think, or you know?" Fiverr asked. "Hey, check it out," they say. And then Paul, for the first time since he hacked into the computer, tells another living human the computer's phone numbers. "Check it out." So Fiverr does. He hangs up, plops down in front of the TV screen he has hooked up to his TRS-80 computer in his bedroom, and dials away. It's a monastic setup for such an ambitious adventurer. A neatly made cot, a low bureau, a desk, a chair, makeshift bookshelves in the corner. The room is so small that the corners of everything touch. This is where Fiverr comes alive, though, in a Spartan room with one small window. Why would he need a bigger pane of glass? He has a view of the whole world on his computer. Outside his room, he's just another painfully thin adolescent with carefully combed hair, just another teenager colliding with uncertainty and the embarrassment of being himself every time his voice cracks, every time he walks into math class late, every time he says hi to a girl. But inside this room, Fiverr is someone else. He's the smartest, coolest dude in cyberspace. He's intuitively hacking out the most complex programs and commands you can imagine. He's learning new things, going new places every day, by himself. He's the dude. The funny thing about Fiverr is, he's so far into the phone system that when he wants to hit a switch, he does it the hard way. He doesn't just dial the switch in question and connect. No, he logs in through something called the 9X Packet Switched Network. This network of computers is much more potent than any single switch. In fact, this network ties together every switch in the New York-New England telephone region. Each is one pearl on the necklace, and Fiverr has his hands on the clasp. But ironically, he has never possessed a single specific phone number for any one of the switches. Of course, he hasn't exactly been lusting for one. It's much more exciting to him to be able to envision the context, the vast splendor of a network of switches all working together, than to play around with any single component. As a little boy, he liked to assemble his own technical elements. But back then, he wouldn't have recognized that the plastic models of ships he painstakingly constructed were really just networks of topsails and rigging and decks. The finished products were elaborate, though, and they all sailed. Fiverr may not possess the password to a switch, but he certainly knows a switch when he calls one. The Laurelton computer is a switch. He phones Eli and Paul and says, "It's not an SCCS. It's a DMS-100. Fiverr happily rattles on about how DMS stands for Digital Multiplex Switch, cheerfully informing them that the multi-million-dollar computer was manufactured by Northern Telecom, a giant telecommunications company that's one of the world's biggest vendors of phone equipment. Fiverr loves to share what he knows with other serious hackers. He even was a kind of mentor to a kid named the Technician for a while. The Technician would call him up, ask a question, get an answer, hang up, try the hack himself, and then call back for further instructions. It made Fiverr feel like a real teacher. DMS. The thing that Paul had been wandering around in for more than a year now has a name. And somebody's been there before who is only too pleased to show him the way. Because that's how it is with Fiverr. He loves to share what he knows. Fiverr says, "You want to get together?" And Paul thinks, "Who is this guy?" He lives at the top of steep stairs in a red brick row house just off Junction Boulevard in a part of Queens called Elmhurst. The neighborhood has been mostly Italian and Irish when Fiverr's parents, Charles and Gloria Abeen, moved in. Children of Italian immigrants, the Abeens had moved east from Brooklyn. As a young man, Charles Abeen had dreamed of being a jazz saxophonist but ended up an officer in the school's custodians union. Gloria Abeen worked in the billing office of the A&S department store in the Queens Mall. One luxury she allows herself every morning is a taxicab ride to work. Just like Paul's neighborhood, Elmhurst over the years saw one generation of immigrants supplanted by another. This is the natural rhythm of New York City, where waves of newcomers wash in and up and out as the strivers move through the city on their way to the suburbs and assimilation. When Dominicans and Puerto Ricans began settling in Elmhurst, the Italian and Irish families headed east to Long Island. But a few hardy souls always seemed to grab hold and refused to be swept out of their neighborhoods. The Abeans stayed and raised three children in their long, narrow house. Their oldest son grew up, got married, and moved out. Their daughters grew up, went to college upstate, and moved out. And now, the Abeans' precocious baby, who they know as Mark, not Fiber, is staying up all night, sitting up at his computer until he sees what he calls the stupidly sunny light of dawn trip in through his window. And then he sleeps through math class. Nobody could ever tell Mark what to do. He knew his ABCs before he was two and was trying to write words before he was old enough to properly grasp a pencil. He held it in his fist, and he shuffled down the steps one at a time, slowly, like the toddler he was, looking for paper. He remembers all this clearly, as if it happened yesterday, because there isn't much Mark hasn't consigned to memory. Phone company acronyms, obscure dial-ups, and being small enough to be bathed in the kitchen sink. It's all there, stored in his brain, and he can pull out the requisite memory any time he wants to review it. There's no point in suggesting that he go to sleep at a reasonable hour. Even since he could walk, Mark has been a step ahead of the rest of the household. They've watched him in a kind of wonder, not sure where he's headed, but trusting his sense of direction. As a child, he was always asking how things worked,